This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk about zombies that actually exist in nature with the author of How to Make a Zombie. He'll tell us how certain bug species use what he calls zombie nannies to raise their young.
And here we thought humans invented zombies.
Well, it turns out bug zombies are really gross, too.
First, we'll look at the rise of single-father households. A new Pew Research Center study shows that the number of single-father families has risen ninefold over the last 50 years.
According to the study, that's twice the rise of single-mother families.
Barbara Risman, senior scholar at the Council on Contemporary Families, is here to break down these numbers for us and to let us know what this change means for American society. Barbara, welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Well, first, let's take a look at this study. Just how big is this jump in the numbers of single dad households?
I think we do have a real major jump in the number of single fathers raising children. I'm a little concerned that the study that came out today overestimates just how big that jump is, because it includes in this rise of single fathers who are living with cohabiting partners raising children. It doesn't make clear if those partners are the mothers of those children, but in fact, many of them are, we know from other research. And so that I think it's a sleight of hand to call a man living with the mother of his children who doesn't happen to be legally married to her a single father. And those kind of men represent 41% of this increase. So that my caution is that there has been an increase, but I think we have to be really careful in the language that we use and whether or not we want to call men who are living with the mothers of their children single fathers.
Well, do we know how many of that group are single fathers who are raising a child without living with a partner?
Yes, 60, if the other 41% are not, so the other, the majority are real single fathers.
The majority are, and this
the
is a jump.
Are. I just wanted to make really clear that it's not quite the article claims that one quarter of all single parents are now single fathers. And that's only true if you include men who are living with the mother of their children as single fathers because they're not legally married. And I think that's a mistake.
Gotcha. And some of the numbers I read, though, I mean, they are compelling whether or not you factor in what you
Absolutely.
Just mentioned, something like in 1960, one in every 100 of these households was a single father household. And now it's one in every 8 or something like that. So there is a big raise that we're looking at.
Oh, there's absolutely a major shift. And I think it's a major shift that resembles and reflects the major shift in what fatherhood means in married couples as well, which is that fathers are no longer seen simply as the contributing to their children's well-being by bringing home a paycheck. They're also have come to be seen and see themselves as caregivers and nurturers as well as providers. And I think that as we have come to rightly define fathers as important for their children in ways beyond the economic, they fulfill that role both when they're married to the mother of those children and after they're married to the mother of those children.
And, you know, it's interesting. I can think back to a year, maybe 2 years ago, there was some press about this trend of buffoonish dads being represented on TV, and the dads were always clueless, and it's sort of, you got the impression that fathers were not really all there when it came to raising families, at least in our imagination and popular culture. Is that changing?
I think that is changing, actually, and I think that as we see in everyday life, fathers bringing their kids to dance classes, showing up at PTA meetings, being the one responsible for good nutrition, that the popular culture will reflect those changes, even if they haven't done so. And there's something else I wanted to mention in terms of numbers. I started out by saying that the numbers here are really inflated because they include men who cohabit with their the mothers of their children. But in some ways, it underestimates the number of men involved in childcare because it doesn't include men who are in joint custody relationships, whose children live with them some of the time, but not all of the time. And there are more and more of them as well in post-divorce households. So that even though it undercounts, it exaggerates the number of fathers in some ways, I think it undercounts it in others.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you wonder, I guess, does this reflect a new parental choice that's taking effect, that dads maybe are choosing in some scenarios that they're the ones who want to have custody of the kids? Or is this just something that we're seeing that's arising out of economic and life necessity?
I think that it reflects fathers choosing different roles in their children's lives and choosing that when they're married as well as when they're divorced or after the relationships end. I think that it's part of a general convergence that we're seeing in society between men and women's roles. It used to be that men and women lived really different kinds of lives. Many women married, had children, withdrew from the labor force, and considered raising children their primary occupation. And their husbands doubled up on shifts and, you know, spent as much time in the labor force as they could to support their households. Now, women are far more likely to remain in the household, in the labor force, and men are far more likely to pick up more of the nurturing at home. And so I think that this is one manifestation of that kind of converging of men and women's lives that has been happening for, at least 50 years.
So on the flip side, does this mean that we're going to be seeing, or we are seeing, fewer single mother households?
Not really, at least not statistically yet, because we still have so many. What we're seeing is a counter trend, which is far more births to single mothers that don't involve the fathers at all, right? Right now, we're about 40% of women who have children do so without being married. And so that even though men are more likely to be single fathers, women are still increasingly likely to be mothers without fathers in their households. So that we have several different social trends happening at the same time. The fathers most likely to be single custodial fathers who are not actually living with the mother of the children are likely to be fathers after divorce. Fathers who once were married is my guess to the women and ended up with custody afterwards.
Well, this is a trend we're going to be watching, see where it plays out from here. Barbara Risman, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Barbara Risman, head of the Sociology Department at the University of Illinois Chicago and a senior scholar at the Council on Contemporary Families.
Coming up next on Central Time, we'll talk to the author of How to Make a Zombie about accounts of zombieism that exist in nature. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kristen Durst joins us now with a look at some headlines we're keeping an eye on.
The millions of protesters who filled city squares in Egypt calling for the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi have been cheering the announcement from the military that Morsi is being replaced. According to the announcement, the Islamist-backed constitution is being suspended and early elections will be scheduled. The move came after Morsi refused to meet the demands of protesters that he give up power. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a bill that sharply limits the adoption of Russian children by people from countries that allow same-sex marriage. The bill is the latest move by Russia to buck the Western trend toward greater acceptance of homosexuality. On Sunday, Putin approved a ban on giving children any information about gays. State agriculture officials are warning farmers that heavy rains following a wet spring in southern Wisconsin would lead to overflowing manure storage facilities. Water quality officials also say spreading manure on already saturated fields could lead to manure running off into nearby streams and lakes.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Zombies are everywhere in our culture these days. They're on books, TV shows, video games.
And I just saw one of this summer's blockbusters, World War Z, centered on, yes, zombies. But our next guest says zombies actually exist in nature.
Well, as long as I don't have to fend one off with a shotgun, I'm okay with that.
Hopefully it won't come to that. We're mostly talking about insects and some other animals. They're examples of mind control, taking over another's body, especially in what our guest calls reproductive parasitism, or zombie nannies. Frank Swain is with us. He's the author of How to Make a Zombie, the Real Life and Death Science of Reanimation and Mind Control. He's here to explain how zombies exist in nature and why we find them so interesting. Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Frank, first of all, why is our culture and maybe why are you so into zombies?
Oh, that's a great question. I think zombies are probably the ultimate blank slate. I mean, with vampires or werewolves, there's a lot of a backstory that you have to kind of fill in. There's a lot of rules that you have to stick to. But zombies are very amenable to any plot. They pretty much can spring from anything from radiation to viruses, and they're cheap to film as well, aren't they? So it doesn't take much in the way of special effects to create a zombie film.
Now, in your book, you cover a lot of zombie ground. We're going to key in this interview on the insect world, and you talk a lot about reproductive parasitism, a five-letter, $5 phrase there. What is that?
So this is essentially a method that some animals will use to help their offspring get a better start in life. And just as flies might lay their eggs on some rotting meat so that, when the eggs hatch, there's a plentiful supply of food there. And that, an animal can push that even further and try to convince another animal to take control of it. So I think everyone, a lot of your listeners will be familiar with cuckoos, for example, who lay their eggs in the nests of other birds and then trust upon those other birds to raise them.
And you have, and not a lot of people can say this, I believe you have a favorite zombie parasitic insect, the emerald cockroach wasp. Tell us, how does that work? How does that zombify other parts of the animal kingdom?
The cockroach wasp is a wonderful creature, a very beautiful, small, slender, shiny green wasp. And it, in particular, as the name suggests, it focuses on cockroaches. And what it will do is when it wants to lay an egg to reproduce, it will find a cockroach, sting it, which will temporarily paralyze the cockroach, which is a lot bigger than the wasp. They're only very small. And it will use that small window to drive a second sting into the brain, or what passes for a brain in a cockroach. And once this happens, the cockroach rouses itself from the first sting. It's not paralyzed anymore. But it's not the same cockroach. It seems to have lost its sort of will. It doesn't run away. It doesn't really seem to have much of a will to do anything. And the wasp will then lay an egg on the abdomen of the cockroach, put it into a burrow and bury it. And when that egg hatches, the small larvae will burrow its way into this cockroach and begin to eat it from the inside out. And all this time, the cockroach doesn't try to do anything about it. It just sits there dumbly and waits for its eventual demise. So a very grisly little beast, the emerald cockroach wasp.
And then what's going on there? I mean, it's affecting I'm not sure if cockroaches have brains per se, but it's affecting the nervous system, the decision-making process of the cockroach. How does that happen?
It's fascinating. If you their legs are still operational, so we're not entirely sure would be the quick answer, but we know that the cockroaches, if they wanted to, they could run away, but for some reason they don't, and they've been sort of almost domesticated, if you want to put it that way, by this sting. So it's something that the wasp understands a lot better than we do, unfortunately.
And what a weird thing to evolve to do, to have this specific target that you sort of mind control and leave your young there to develop in their early phase.
Well, as I stated before, a lot of animals will leave their eggs near a food supply. So it's but the unfortunate part about that is that that food may rot or something else may come along and steal it before your offspring has a chance to hatch out and make use of it. So the obvious next step would be to lay your eggs on something that is still alive so that it stays fresh. But to do that, you need to convince it to play a role in this relationship. And obviously, that's not something that the animal that gets eaten is usually keen on. So you have to be quite persuasive in your techniques.
And the emerald cockroach wasp is not alone. There are other species who do this kind of thing?
Absolutely. There are more than we could possibly count. Another fantastic example would be a small Costa Rican wasp, which performs a similar feat on spiders. So it'll sting a spider, and again, this momentarily paralyzes the spider and gives it enough time to lay that egg on the spider's belly. And when this egg hatches, everything seems to continue as normal. The spider goes on building webs and catching flies. And all the time, this little wasp, the larvae, is sort of like a leech. It's latched on there, and it's sucking out the juices of the spider and helping itself to grow. But when it comes time for that larvae to pupate, to go into a cocoon and emerge as an adult wasp, that sort of transformation that insects undergo, something very, very strange happens, and that is that the spider begins to weave a web that is not like any web that the spider has ever done before. And it's not for the spider. This is a web that is in particular designed for the larvae. It is a crib, you might say, a little secure platform that's nice and safe in which that larvae can curl up and pupate and undergo its metamorphosis. And it's doing this at the behest of this parasite that's latched onto it. Somehow, that wasp larvae is feeding a venom, feeding a poison, some kind of drug into the spider, which changes the way that the spider spins a web. And again, we have no idea how they managed to do that.
And that's, we're getting a little closer to a zombie sort of thing as we think of it. It's actually taking control of the behavior of this thing to help the host or help the wasp and not really caring about the future well-being of that spider.
Oh, absolutely. This is very much the final stages of that poor spider's life. As soon as it finishes the new web, this structure, then it'll finally kick the bucket. And the fascinating thing is that if you remove this larvae several days, you know, once the web building begins, but before it's complete, the spider will go on building that strange web for a few days, and then it'll stop and it'll go back to its regular web building. So there's something in there, some kind of drug that's in that spider making it do that. But right now, we don't know what that is.
And now, outside the wasp family, what other are there smaller parasites that might affect the behavior of other insects or animals?
Oh, absolutely. This it runs the full gamut through the animal kingdom. And perhaps my favorite one is, do we have time to talk about toxoplasma?
Because I'd love yes, please, to yeah.
Okay, well, this is become, it's very popularized now. I think a lot of people may have heard of it already, but it's Toxoplasma gondii, which is a parasite of cats. And it'll infect just about anything warm-blooded. And it uses other animals to sort of spread itself around. But it can only complete its life cycle in a cat. And one of the favorite animals it uses to spread itself about is a mouse or a rat. Now, this is a bit of a problem because if you have the bug and it's inside of a rat, it can't get out. It can't walk over to a cat. So how does it get back to a cat to complete its life cycle? Mice, they're not very fond. We've seen the Tom and Jerry films. They're not very fond of cats, and they try to stay away from them where possible. So to this end, we have a similar situation where Toxoplasma gondii will start to influence the brain of this rodent, and it will start behaving in ways that are very, very unusual. The mouse will come out during daytime. It will lose its fear of the smell of cat urine, for example, which mice typically are very, very terrified from. And it becomes a lot slower. Its reaction times are slower. It's bolder. It's more risk-taking. And all of these combined sort of reckless behaviors soon enough deliver it into the jaws of a passing cat. And that's the parasite's doing. But the fascinating thing is, as I mentioned earlier, these parasites will infect anything warm-blooded, and they get into humans. And we're starting to do experiments where we see people who have been exposed to Toxoplasma gondii, to this bug, show very, very subtle shifts in their behavior as well. Now, I hasten to add, this is no reason for anyone listening to go and throw their cat out or anything like that. You would only ever see these changes sort of on a population scale. But people do tend to become, say, more sociable, more risk-taking. Their reaction times are slightly slowed. So it's the parasite. It's doing the same thing to us as it would do to a mouse.
But it doesn't do them as much good because we're not going to go out and get eaten presumably buy a cat exactly. and help spread.
We're not the...
Unless we really work at it.
Exactly. This is it. Like I said, this is not something that that people would have to worry about. But it is a fantastic example of how your own behaviors, and what I often say to people when I tell them about this, is if you enjoy roller coasters, if you enjoy gambling, if you enjoy racing around in your car, potentially that might not be 100% you. There might be a very small part of that which is influenced by another organism. And I think for humans, that's a very unsettling idea. And that really gets to the core of our fascination with zombies, which is that they are like us. They move around. They walk and sometimes they talk, but they're not 100% human. That brain process has been subsumed by something else. And so it's endlessly fascinating.
Frank, thank you so much for joining us. We'll watch for Hollywood to option some of the chapters of your book.
Excellent. Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed.
All right. Thanks a lot for joining us. That was Frank Swain. He's author of How to Make a Zombie.
And coming up tomorrow on our July 4th edition of Central Time, we'll talk about the science of fireworks, the chemistry and the physics that make the big bangs and the bright lights.
So we can figure out why the show we enjoyed worked. That'll be fun. We'll also talk about the early days of the Wisconsin Territory, back before we became a state, and how we celebrated Independence Day in 1836.
And we'll solve the mystery of the Platteville M, that mysterious Platteville M, on our first Curious Wisconsin segment.
That's one I've been wondering about a lot. Looking forward to that. That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to field and stream editor Bill Heavey about his experience as a hunter-gatherer, foraging, fishing, and otherwise getting his food from nature. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Be sure to check out Central Time on Facebook and Twitter to keep tabs on what we're doing. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in a bit, we'll be looking at fireworks laws in Wisconsin and what you can and can't shoot off in your backyard this 4th of July.
First, the misadventures of a suburban hunter-gatherer. Field and Stream editor Bill Heavey decided to take food into his own hands. By hunting, fishing, foraging, and gardening, he decided to cut out the middleman and live off the land.
Well, needless to say, things didn't exactly go according to plan. So veering slightly from his original idea, he set off to meet the people who could pull those things off and help him do it as well. Bill chronicles the journey in his new book called It's Only Slow Food Until You Try to Eat It.
And we want to hear from you, too. Are you someone who hunts or gathers or grows your own food? Is it worth it? Or would you rather just go to the grocery store? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@wpr.org.
And Bill Heavey, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, it sounds like this idea to pursue wild food came to you while you were discovering hunting. And you actually found you had quite something special going there. When did you first know that what you were doing was feeling kind of good?
It was actually the first time I'd finally killed a deer. I'd been teaching myself to bow hunt, basically, because I didn't have, I didn't know people who hunted. And it's not, incidentally, not the fastest way to learn. But after 3 years, I finally killed a deer, and I was eating it, and I realized that, you know, I had made this meat. I had, cut out all the middlemen, and there was something that felt really subversive about it, and kind of almost devious, and that I like that feeling.
You like to feel devious about your food, huh?
I like to feel like I was cutting. There was something very satisfying about cutting out all those other people.
And what about the food? Do you think it tasted better as you were eating that venison than if you had just grabbed something off the shelf?
Yeah, it did. It tasted completely different, and now I hardly eat beef at all.
Now, so going hunting for your own meat seems pretty hard. You said it took you 3 years. It seems to me like it would be easier just to plant a little plot and harvest some lettuce and radishes. How did you go from deer to sourcing more of your food?
Well, deer was sort of gave me the germ of the idea, and then I thought, how far can I take this in other directions? And so I decided to, you know, I'm a child of the suburbs. I grew up, you know, completely cut off from nature, I realize now. So I decided that I would, you know, try a vegetable garden and try learning to forage. And so I set about to do those things.
How hard was it when you started off? This is stuff you did not know a lot about. You were a creature of the suburban grocery store, like a lot of us are. How daunting was that challenge?
I think if I'd really known what I was up against, I wouldn't have done it. But fortunately, I wasn't too aware, and so I just kept going.
Ignorance can be your friend.
Ignorance is totally your friend, I think. The first time I was trying to, you know, I knew, for instance, that I had to rototill my backyard and to make a vegetable garden, and I rented this rototiller that was so powerful that I became sort of mesmerized by it and tore up twice as much of my backyard as I intended, and then ended up having to rent the thing two more times because I found out that I needed to add lime to my soil,
oh.
And I found out that I needed amendments to the soil. And, you know, by the time I was went into the rental shop for the third time, the guys were like, dude, you could have bought this thing by now.
So how did the garden turn out after all that?
It turned out pretty well. I found out for myself something I'd been hearing for a long time, which is that, you know, the homegrown tomato just beats a supermarket tomato, you know, coming and going.
What did it taste like? Can you describe the difference, that first ripe, juicy tomato that you plucked off your own vine?
A really ripe tomato just gives off this aroma, even before you even pick it, that's just, it's almost like a musk or something. It's a really wonderful, kind of seductive, you know, almost sexy odor, and, you know, a tomato that you've just taken from your backyard and sliced and had with some mozzarella or something is just fantastic.
All right, you had me at sexy tomato. So I want to hear about Paula Smith, because you had mentors along the way. You did learn to do some stuff like the rototilling, but you had mentors because this was no small task you were taking on. And there was a woman named Paula Smith who really showed you some of the ropes.
Yeah, Paula Smith, I met at Fletcher's Boathouse, which is an institution. It's been along the Potomac. It's been on Fletcher's Cove, inside the Beltway, you know, about 3 miles from the White House, and it's this kind of power center that has attracted river rats and oddballs and fishermen and you know, outlaws for 150 years. And I met Paula there one day, and there was this woman who was dressed like a man, you know, cursed like a sawmill foreman, looked like she might be homeless, might be crazy. And over time, I found out that she knew more about, you know, the woods and the waters and plants and animals than anybody I'd ever met. And she had a patch of watercress right in downtown D.C. That she ate from, you know, routinely. And so she took me there and pulled up the, she goes, you know, show you something. And she shows me this watercress and hands me some, and I'm eating it. And all of a sudden I look around and there's, like, you know, deer droppings everywhere and trash. And this was, you know, near homeless people's, you know, were camping out in this. And I said, Paul, what are we doing? You know, this is crazy. She goes, no, look over here. What, that stuff over there? I wouldn't eat that. But here, all this is filtered through sand. You know what the Greeks used? The Romans used to clean water? Sand.
Mm-hmm.
And so she just constantly amazed me with, you know, what she knew. And, you know, little by little, I would get her to share some of her best trees and places like that. But she was, you know, she was kind of my muse throughout this book.
Now, you went all over the country, in fact, beyond the country of the U.S., to forage for food. But is part of the lesson here that you can find food like this, this watercress, these tomatoes that you grew, that you can do this pretty locally?
Oh, you can do it very locally.
In a city, even.
Yeah, in the city, or, you know, right now I live in Arlington, Virginia, and right now, well, mulberries are just finishing up, but you could gather, you know, scads of mulberries and freeze them, and turns out they're incredibly nutritious. There are wine berries here, which are a kind of, they're actually not native, but they've been here so long that they're become naturalized, and it's like a raspberry. You know, they're daylily. You can eat the buds of daylily plants sautéed or a wonderful vegetable. You know, there's all kinds of stuff.
You just say you could eat daylilies?
Yes, the buds.
Really?
Pods, before they open up, when they're about the size of your little finger, and they're delicious. You just steam them up, a little butter and salt, and you've got yourself a wonderful vegetable.
What does it taste like?
It's pretty mild, but it has a peppery kind of aftertaste.
The thing
that I noticed eating wild plants was, I mean, you know, we all eat salads, we all eat raw vegetables, but when you're eating something that you've just picked that's grown wild, I don't know how to explain this exactly. I had this sense that I was eating a living thing in a way that I never had before.
And did that in turn make you feel more alive?
Yeah, it did. I mean, and really, you know, it's funny. I started out writing this book thinking it was one story, and, you know, the story is never what you think it is. It's something else. And what I realized this book is really about is people's relationship to nature, and that, you know, we're never more ourselves than when we're connected to nature. And when you find somebody who really knows what they're doing, who's really connected to nature, who's not, you know, for me, this was kind of a stunt. I was going out and trying to do these things. But then I sought out people for whom, you know, getting their own food was not a stunt and, you know, was not something out of the ordinary. It was just part of their daily life. And to do that, they, without exception, all these people had their finger on the pulse of the natural world around them in a really powerful way. And they got, it nurtured them. And I think it nurtures all of us. And I think, you know, most of us have lost that. And it just made me aware of how much we've lost.
And we'll talk more about how we can regain that as we come back and talk more with Bill Heavey. His book is called It's Only Slow Food Until You Try to Eat It. And we'd love to hear from you, too. Do you share this experience that Bill is talking about, where you really feel more alive and more connected despite the effort when you get your food from the land? And what challenges have you faced? What are the rewards? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Now here's a check of the latest headlines with WPR's Kristen Durst.
Two U.S. officials say Egyptian defense leaders who ousted President Mohamed Morsi today have assured the U.S. that they are not interested in long-term rule. The official says the leaders, in calls with Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, pledged to put a civilian government in place quickly. Americans thinking about buying a home are getting a bit of a break from mortgage rates this week. After rising to its highest level in 2 years last week, the average rate on a 30-year-old fixed-rate loan is down by nearly 0.2 of a point this week. And that could prompt home buyers to act quickly before rates rise again. The Wisconsin Supreme Court says a mother and father who prayed for their dying daughter instead of taking her to a doctor were properly convicted of homicide. The state's highest court issued that ruling today. Dale and Leilani Newman were both convicted in the 2008 death of 11-year-old Madeline Newman.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Bill Heavey and with you at 1-800-642-1234. Are you someone who hunts, gathers, grows your own food? What do you find so rewarding about that? Or do you think, you know, it's just as good to just go to the grocery store? What's your take if you've made that foray into the wild food movement? And we go back to Bill now. As you were pursuing your wild food agenda, where's the next place you went after you left your backyard?
Oh, goodness. The next place I went, well, actually, the next place I went was up to Alaska to go caribou hunting with the Gwich'in Indians, who are a tribe that I'd never heard of, but in fact are scattered all across northeastern Alaska. And their oral tradition tells them that they've been following a single herd of caribou for 20,000 years. And these people were nomads as recently, some of them, as 100 years ago. And they still go out and hunt caribou. And the meat that a hunter brings back is still sort of communal property. You know, he's expected to share that with others in the village, and first and foremost with, you know, old people and children.
Hmm. So you went along on that. What was that experience like?
That was it was just amazing. I was the guest of one of the village's chief hunters, a man named Charlie Swaney, and he would just wake up in the morning and kind of sniff the air, and somehow he would be able to tell you what the caribou, you know, 25 miles away were doing, and he was right enough times that I got over my skepticism, and when Charlie told me something, you know, I knew I could take it to the bank.
Well, I want to go to the phones now. We've got pretty much full lines here. We go to Becky first in Milwaukee. Hi, Becky.
Hi.
Hi. What you thinking about slow food?
Yeah, well, I really resonated with the comment about food when you eat, like, fresh food and it makes you come alive. I actually work for a meal program in downtown Milwaukee, and we have a project called the Produce Preservation Project. And the object of the project is to bring in as much fresh vegetables and produce as possible to incorporate into our community meal program. And I just think it's so important to have these conversations and to connect people with food. I think food is one of the most important things. And I just, this project that I've been blessed to work with has really helped me come alive in the past year. So thanks.
Well, thank you for that call, Becky, and it sounds pretty familiar, right, Bill?
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
And we'll go to another call. Hans joins us from Berlin, or New Berlin. There we go. Hi, Hans.
Hi, how are you? It's Hans from New Berlin.
Thank you.
The thing about it is when you harvest a deer and you take it in and you you clean it, you cut it up yourself and you eat it, you know it's real. It's not like going to the grocery store and you don't know where that came from. You have no connection to that animal. And the same thing when you go to your backyard, you go to the fields in your neighborhood and you pick the wild grapes and the raspberries and you bake the pie yourself and make the wild jelly. There's just something, it's real. It's not just something you bought. It's something that you have achieved, something that you are bringing home for your family. And it makes it more real. And it's emotionally hard to describe how important and how enriching that can be.
I think you described it pretty well there. Well, what do you say, Bill?
I sometimes think of that as I agree totally with your caller. I think of it as sort of closing the circle. You know, that you're doing the whole thing yourself, and there's a sense of completeness there. That and you know, it's a funny thing. It's a subtle thing, and looked at from the outside, it's easy to kind of make fun of, and you know. But when you do it, and it, you know, you have to, when you experience it, it changes you.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Hans. And let's move next to Charlie, who joins us from Blanchardville. And we do have a free line now for you at 1-800-642-1234. How would you describe what's special about eating wild food, something like a berry that's hot from the sun or that tomato that you grew yourself? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How about you?
Good. Hey, Bill. It's nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Charlie.
I read your articles religiously from Field and Stream.
Oh, well, thank you.
And You had an article in there about making meat when you cut all your own meat up, and that's what I do. And it's, you know, it's just nothing like it. This is where your food comes from. People buy meat in the store and they don't know what, you know, where it was raised or anything. One of my favorite things was I was turkey hunting with my granddaughter, and she shot a big turkey. We went home and I cooked her some elk steak, and she just loved it. And the next day for breakfast, I said, "What do you want?" She looked at me. She goes, "Do you have any more of that elk steak?" And I'm like, "Sure." We have our own garden also, and half the time we're eating all the food we grew and whatever we harvested. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
All right. Thank you so much, Charlie, for sharing your stories with us. And by the way, if your curiosity was piqued, just like mine was, about eating the daylily bud, our producer Galen put up a link on Facebook that shows you how to cook and eat daylilies. Gosh, mine are so beautiful now, though, Bill. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it. I got to be honest with you. They're so beautiful. But
oh, daylilies.
Yeah, daylilies. They must.
But they're while they're blooming, they have, you know, you don't have to take a lot from each plant. A lot of times you'll find daylilies in a big bank, and each plant will shoot up, you know, a dozen flowers. So you can take, you know, just a few, and, you know, it won't have any. And what actually happens in to plants like that is that it tends to increase their yield.
Really?
I've talked to foragers who have told me about, you know, working over a patch of berries or, you know, whatever, vegetables, whatever it is, and they've actually come back and discovered over time that, you know, judicious harvesting of the plants, they actually, you know, there's more there than when they started. So there's the danger of taking too much, and it's easy to take too much. But you can also do it and actually, you know, not all human interaction with the landscape is bad.
Right. Especially when we consider, just like you've been saying here, that we're part of the landscape. You know, we're part
exactly.
of this ecosystem.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take another call. Jeff joins us in Fox Lake. Hi, Jeff. Jeff, you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Yes. I just wanted to see what an interesting subject it was. Individual have on. It's very interesting to bring up, you know, the fact that the other people have said you're closing the circle once you do everything yourself. Another aspect of that is when there's certain products that you just can't buy or would have. You mentioned, well, isn't it easier to go to the store? Well, there's so many of these things you just can't get. You know, you have to do it for yourself. As far as, like, I'm raising a family here, well, we got our own meat, milk, and eggs. I can't. The products that you buy have no, they're not even close to what I can raise on my own.
Yeah. Right. You know, I heard somewhere that the average supermarket vegetable is 17 days old when it's sold.
Yeah, it's a lot different from, you know, getting something right when it's at the peak of ripeness there, like you were talking about. All right. Well, thank you so much to you, Jeff, for that call. And time for one last quick call. Steve in Lake Geneva. Hi there.
Hi. Hey, thanks for this. The Central Time is awesome. I love it.
Excellent. Thank you.
And good luck with that. But I wanted to say two things real quick. The Native Americans in the Native American community down here at Powell's and stuff, they say that the deer and the caribou and the elk are the real fast food. That's the true fast food because they're so fast on the ground. And
yeah.
It's pretty funny. But the reason I forage, I mean, other than for being able to eat things that you can't buy in a store, like right now the sulfur shelf mushrooms are all out because we've had, you know, an ungodly amount of rain. And normally I don't pick those till September. So we're picking those right now.
Wait, what are they called, Steve?
Sulfur shelf.
Sulfur shelf?
Chicken of the woods is another name. They're kind of an orange shelf mushroom.
Chicken of the woods. Man, I love mushrooms. I'll be out looking for those.
These are so good, and they're easy to find. You can't mistake them for any poisonous mushroom or anything. But it's just, when you get out in the woods, it's a whole different world. You know, it's not like being at home. It's not like going to work in a city or anything. you're out there and you never know what you're going to see. You never know what you're going to find. You know, there'll be deer walking by. You don't even, you know, you don't have that happening in your front yard or, you know, or when you're in Milwaukee or Chicago.
That's a beautiful way to put it, Steve. Thank you so much for that call. And Bill Heavey, thank you so much to you. I think you've inspired us all here to get out there and get foraging and eating the food at the peak of freshness, looking for those sexy tomatoes, too. So thank you so much, Bill.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Bill Heavey's book is called It's Only Slow Food Until You Try to Eat It.
My best foraging experiences have been eating mulberries off of trees over parking lots and along streets. And I've had people make fun of me for doing that. Like, what? That guy's eating off a tree. Well, coming up, we're going to get the news, and then we'll take a look at fireworks laws in Wisconsin. What can you set off and where? I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And don't forget, you can check out that recipe for how to prepare your own daylily buds, like Bill Healy was just talking about, on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.